It's time for Radio Freethinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of sparks. Cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. This week, it's a Web Wisdom edition, with a couple of segments from Crash Course and some from Healthcare Triage. Let's start off with Crash Course, talking about the history of intelligence. If you're smart, you'll listen in.
The smarty pants, egghead, brainiac. You've heard terms like these before. Maybe you've even been on the receiving end of one of them. But actually, defining intelligence is a lot trickier than just coming up with new names for smart people. I mean, intelligence isn't like height or weight. You can't just toss someone on a scale and get an exact measurement. It has different meanings for different cultures and ages and skill sets. So what is intelligence? That's a question that doesn't give us a lot of answers, but it does open up a bunch of other equally important and interesting questions. Like, what influences it? And how can it be assessed? Is it a single, general ability, or does it cover a range of aptitudes and skills and talents? How do things like creativity and innovation factor in? Or genetics, environment, or education? And what about emotional intelligence? Most agree that it's best to think of intelligence not as a concrete thing so much as a concept. The ability to learn from experience, to solve problems, and use knowledge to adapt to new experiences. We've often used intelligence tests to assess and compare mental aptitude, but these tests have a long, complex, and dark history. I mean, there are Nazis involved, so yeah. So as you'll see, there are reasons that intelligence is one of the most hotly debated subjects in psychology. It's complicated and controversial. What if I'm the world's greatest Rubik's Cube solver, but a terrible speller, or a truly gifted artist who's barely mastered long division? Could anyone say I was intelligent or not based on those different aptitudes, or would it be more accurate to measure my brain power on several different scales? Around the turn of the 20th century, British psychologist Charles Spearman suggested that yes, we do have one comprehensive general intelligence that underlies all of our specific mental abilities. He called it the G factor. Spearman conceded that while people may have special talents like basket weaving, or saxophone solos, or doing crossword puzzles, those things still fell under G. And he helped develop a statistical procedure called factor analysis to try to determine how certain clusters of skills might correlate with another one. Like, say, someone who tests well in spatial skills might be good with numbers. We might then refer to that cluster of skills, that factor, as spatial numeric reasoning. But to Spearman, the G factor was something of an uber factor, connected to all intelligent behavior from architecture to healing to survival skills. And it's why people who do well on one kind of cognitive test tend to do well on others. But as you can imagine, reducing intelligence to a single numerical test score was and is problematic. L.L. Thurstone, an American pioneer of psychometrics and one of Spearman's first challengers, was not into ranking people on a single scale. Thurstone administered 56 different tests to his subjects, then used them to identify 7 clusters of mental abilities. By this system, you might turn out to be great at, like, verbal comprehension, but less stellar at something like numerical ability. Sounds fair. But when researchers followed up on his findings, they actually did see that high scores in one aptitude usually meant good scores in the others, essentially backing up some evidence for some kind of G factor. Even though their ideas did not often align, Spearman and Thurstone together paved the way for more contemporary theories on intelligence. For example, American psychologist Howard Gardner views intelligence as multiple abilities that come in different forms. He references instances of brain damage where one ability may be destroyed while others stay perfectly intact. Savants usually have some limited mental abilities, but one exceptional ability when it comes to, like, computing figures or memorizing the complete works of Shakespeare. To Gardner, this suggests that we have multiple intelligences beyond the G factor. In fact, he believes that we have 8 intelligences, ranging from our skills with numbers and words to our ability to understand physical space and the natural world. American psychologist Robert Sternberg tends to agree with Gardner, though he boils them down into 3 intelligences: analytical or problem-solving intelligence, creative intelligence were the ability to adapt to new situations and practical intelligence for everyday tasks. Both of these models seem reasonable, too, and Gardner and Sternberg's work has helped teachers appreciate students' variety of talents. But research has suggested that even these different ways to be smart are also linked by some underlying general intelligence factor. So what about other less tangible forms of intelligence like creativity, our ability to produce ideas that are both novel and valuable? How could a test that demands one correct answer account for more creative solutions, so-called divergent thinking? Well, traditional intelligence tests can't. And so far, while we do have some tests that look at creative potential, we don't have a standardized system for quantifying creativity. But Sternberg and his colleagues have identified five main components of creativity, which are useful for framing our understanding of what creative intelligence is and how it works. And when you go through the list, you know who I think is really great at almost all of them? Sherlock Holmes. Hear me out. First, we got expertise, or a well-developed base of knowledge. This just means knowing a lot about a lot, whether it's arcane poisons, jellyfish behavior, or how to recognize a secret passage behind a bookshelf. Expertise provides the mind with all sorts of data to work with and combine in new ways. Obviously, Sherlock has incredible imaginative thinking skills too, which provide him with the ability to see things in new ways, recognize patterns, and make connections. He loves nothing more than rehashing these breadcrumb trails for the dopey constables at the end of the case. Sternberg also thought a venturesome personality contributes to creativity. By hanging around opium dens and chasing thugs and generally courting danger, Sherlock routinely seeks new experiences, tolerates risk, and perseveres in overcoming obstacles. And everyone knows he's driven by intrinsic motivation. I mean, he wants to help the widow discover the thief and everything, but really Sherlock is driven by his own interest and sense of challenge. He gets pleasure from the work itself. And finally, Sherlock benefits from a creative environment which sparks, supports, and refines his ideas. For so affectionately maintaining this environment on Sherlock's behalf, we largely have Dr. Watson to thank. Sherlock was obviously an academic and creative genius, but he was pretty weak in another form of intelligence. The emotional kind. Emotional intelligence, defined in 1997 by psychologists Peter Salovey and John Mayer, not that one, is the ability to perceive, understand, manage, and use emotions. I don't know about you, but I know plenty of smart people who have a hard time processing social information. The most brilliant mathematician may struggle to communicate with colleagues and neighbors or staff at the local deli. Likewise, Sherlock often annoys, offends, or even baffles those around him. Perceiving emotions means being able to recognize them in faces and even music and film and stories. Understanding emotions relates to being able to predict them and how they might change, and managing emotions comes down to knowing how to appropriately express yourself in various situations. And finally, emotional intelligence also means using emotions to enable adaptive or creative thinking, like knowing how to manage conflict or comfort a grieving friend or work well with others. Much like creative intelligence, emotional intelligence can be measured to some degree through testing, but there's no standardized way to, like, assign a numerical value. So if we can't perfectly quantify things like creativity or emotional smarts, how did we come up with a way to measure intelligence? Well, as I mentioned earlier, it's a sordid story. The first attempts to do it in the Western world began with English scientist Francis Galton in the 1800s. Taking a page from his famous cousin Charles Darwin's theories on natural selection, Galton wondered how that premise might extend to humans' natural ability when it came to intelligence. He suggested that our smarts have a lot to do with heredity, so if we encourage smart people to breed with each other, we could essentially create a master race of geniuses. If that sounds a little sketchy, it's because it was, like, really, really sketchy. This study of how to selectively and supposedly improve a human population, especially by encouraging breeding in some people and discouraging it in others, is called eugenics, a term Galton himself coined, and I'll get back to in a minute. But around the turn of the 20th century, when eugenics was taking off, the French government mandated that all children must attend school. Many of these kids had never been in a classroom, and teachers wanted to figure out how they could identify kids who needed extra help. Enter Alfred Binet and Theodore Simon, two French psychologists who were commissioned to develop a test to measure a child's so-called mental age. The concept of a kid's mental age is essentially the level of performance associated with a certain chronological age. So if six-year-old Bruno tests as well as the average six-year-old, he'd have a mental age of six. Binet believed that his tests could measure a child's current mental abilities, but that intelligence wasn't a fixed inborn thing. He believed a person's capabilities could be raised with proper attention, self-discipline, and practice. In other words, he was no eugenicist. eugenicist, he was hoping that his tests would improve children's education by identifying those who needed extra attention. But Binet also feared that these tests would, in the wrong hands, be used to do just the opposite, labeling children as lost causes, limiting their opportunities. And wow, was he onto something, because that is pretty much exactly what happened. German psychologist William Stern used revisions of Binet and Simone's work to create the famous intelligence quotient, or IQ measurement. At the time, your IQ was simply your mental age divided by your chronological age multiplied by 100. So, for example, Bruno is 6, and so is his mental age, so his IQ ranks at 100, but his little sister Betty is a 4-year-old with a mental age of 5, so her IQ would be 125. That formula works pretty well for measuring kids, but it falls apart when it comes to adults who don't hit measurable developmental steps like kids do. I mean, there's no real difference between a mental age of 34 and 35. But Stanford professor Lewis Terman started promoting the widespread use of intelligence testing in the early 1900s, and with his help, the U.S. government began the world's first mass administration of intelligence tests when it assessed World War I Army recruits and immigrants fresh off the boat. Unlike Binet, Terman did use these numerical findings as a kind of label, and he thought his tests could, as he put it, ultimately result in curtailing the reproduction of feeble-mindedness. This kind of testing played right into eugenicist sensibilities, and soon the eugenics movement in the U.S. had a pretty good fan club, raising money from the Carnegies and Rockefellers, and with proponents working at Harvard and Columbia and Cornell. In the first half of the 20th century, intelligence tests were used to enforce the sterilization of around 60,000 people, around a third of whom were in California. Most were poor white women, often unwed mothers or prostitutes. Other eugenics efforts persisted further into the century, and there's evidence of poor African-American, Native American, or Latina women being forcibly or covertly sterilized in large numbers as recently as the 1970s. But you know who really loved their eugenics? The Nazis. Hitler and his cronies took the idea of intelligence testing to even darker conclusions. The Nazis were all about selecting against so-called feeble-mindedness and other undesirable traits as they sought to strengthen what they saw as their Aryan nation. They sterilized or simply executed hundreds of thousands of victims based on their answers to IQ test questions that were really more about adhering to social norms than measuring actual intelligence. Questions like, who was Bismarck and what does Christmas signify? So you can see how this terrifying history still makes some people leery of how such tests are administered, interpreted, and weighted. Today, we understand that intelligence, as defined by all the people we've talked about here, does appear to be a real and measurable phenomenon. But no one can say that they've disentangled all of the would-be genetic, environmental, educational, and socioeconomic components of it. In the end, it's best to think of intelligence as something about which we've still got a lot to learn. Today, your intelligent mind learned about the history of how we think about and define different types of intelligence, what the G-factor is, and how Sherlock Holmes is incredibly intelligent but emotionally unintelligent. You also learned about the history and methods of intelligence testing, IQ scores, and how eugenics turned to the dark side and has since made even talking about intelligence kind of controversial.
I hope that didn't test your understanding. On that note, we'll be back after this break.
Last night, I left the bar. I was thirsty, and I don't drink wine. I was desperate. I needed blood. I turned to the only place I could. The only place that could possibly help me.
Hello, Canadian Blood Services.
Hello. I need some blood. A. Positive or negative, it doesn't matter.
I'm sorry, we're all out of A positive and negative. Would you like some O instead?
No. No, that won't do. Thank you. Good night. Save me. Save yourself. Give blood. Voluntarily.
This message was brought to you courtesy of the Canadian Blood Services and CITR Radio 101.9 FM.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker, Vancouver's best skeptical radio show program. And we're back. On the show, the concept of privilege has come up more than once and in many different contexts. It may surprise some of you, but history itself can also suffer from this. That the people who write history are Well, they're biased, and often their recording of and interpretation of history will express this bias. So let's listen into Crash Course as they talk about the rise of the West and how that idea can be used to understand historical methodology.
Hi, I'm John Green. This is Crash Course World History, and today we're going to talk about how history gets written.
Mr. Green, I want to write books about history when I grow up.
Well, we're not going to talk about the process of writing history today, me from the past. Also, you are a liar, so you're never going to be a history writer, because try as you might, you can't stop making things up. Maybe someday, if you're lucky, you'll write a historical novel, although probably not, because, you know, it involves research, which you also suck at. So today we're going to talk about how historians answer questions and the choices they make in turning their ideas into books. We like to think of history as being the story of what happened, so there's no ambiguity or whatever. It's just, you know, in 1776, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. This is part of our thinking that, like, math is fact-based and literature is opinion. So we imagine history as being, like, over toward the facty stuff. But in truth, literature has a lot of facts in it. There are poems that are objectively good and others that are objectively bad. And if you've ever been to a mathematician party and heard mathematician arguments, you'll know that math has a lot of opinions in it. What, I go to a lot of math parties, that's cool. My point is that that whole, like, fact to opinion continuum we imagine in academics doesn't really make sense. We just need to learn to ignore that and think instead about how to examine the world critically. So today we're going to examine the ways that different historians have tackled a really problematic issue, the rise of the West. So what do rise and West even mean in that phrase? Well, let's go to the thought bubble. So the West is a geographical designation, kind of. It means, like, Western Europe, North America, and Australia, which, as you can see here, are west of Asia, and also east of Asia. In fact, everything is both east and west of everything else, because it's a globe. But the West is also kind of a culture. It's a set of ideas influenced by Judeo-Christian thought and Greek philosophy, with a little Enlightenment rationalism and Adam Smith's economics thrown in. Anyway, it's complicated, like all civilizations that span multiple continents, but most of you at least have an idea in your head when I talk about the West. And then there's the question of what we mean by rise when we talk about the rise of the West, which leads us back to the philosophical question of the nature of history itself. I mean, is history a series of rises and falls, like the story of the Roman Empire, or is it cyclical, like the Mandate of Heaven narrative that we saw when we looked at early Chinese history? So you could say, in fact, that the phrase itself, the rise of the West, is a little bit Western. The whole thing's a bit nebulous. And that makes it a popular subject for historians to tackle, because you can hang a lot of ideas on it. Like Ian Morris, who teaches at Stanford, wrote a book called Why the West Rules, for now, which casts the question in terms of political, military, and economic dominance. And Victor Davis Hanson made this idea of dominance more explicit in his book on military history, Carnage and Culture, Landmark Battles and the Rise to Western Power, which also offers a pretty straightforward reason why the West became so powerful. It won a lot of wars. Thanks, Thought Bubble. Another way to think about this question is in terms of, like, success and failure. That's how Daron Acemoglu and James Robinson approached it in their 2012 book, Why Nations Fail, The Origins of Power, Prosperity, and Poverty. These guys had two big ideas. First, that success can be defined by wealth as well as political power. And secondly, that when we look at successes, we shouldn't look at individuals or communities or continents. We should look at nation states. Now, this book isn't explicitly about the West, but if you look at the countries that they're talking about as successes and failures, it seems like they're talking about kind of the same thing we are. Their successful nations are all in what we think of as the West, with a couple of important exceptions in Japan and Southern Africa. So Acemoglu teaches economics at MIT, and Robinson teaches government at Harvard, which is important because they're not, like, academically trained historians. Some would say that's an advantage, but you know who wouldn't say that? Historians. But anyway, if your training is in economics and government, then you're going to see history through the lens of economics and politics, in the same way that if you're trained as an accountant, you might see history as an interminable series of ledgers to be balanced, which it kind of is. And if you're, say, a novelist, you'll probably see history as a series of narratives, and you'll insert narrative even when it doesn't necessarily exist. How we frame historical questions is extremely important, as is the way that we're trained and the tools we use to try to seek answers. So Acemoglu and Robinson focus on institutions and claim that a nation is successful when its economic and political institutions are inclusive. This focus on institutions explains a lot, and it's very convincing, and it corrects previous theories. For example, Montesquieu's idea that tropical nations tend to be poorer, either because the people tended to be lazy and to lack inquisitiveness, or because diseases and poor soil inhibit economic growth. But according to Acemoglu and Robinson, the data just doesn't support Montesquieu's conclusions. Yeah, that's a little problem. Oh, Oh, it's time for the open letter.
But first, let's see what's in the Globe today. Oh, it's Montesquieu. Do you have a first name, by the way?
Oh, he does. His full name is Charles-Louis de Secondat Baron de la Brède et de Montesquieu, which explains why we only call him Montesquieu. Anyway, an open letter to Montesquieu.
Dear Montesquieu, you had so many good ideas. Separation of powers, that's a definite winner. You basically coined the word despotism. That's a great word. I mean, before the word despotism, our only word for that thing was, like, government. But this idea that you had that poor people were doomed to stay poor has proven astonishingly powerful. And it's also entirely wrong.
Fortunately, Montesquieu, most of us have moved on from your theories about poverty, although just recently. Best wishes. John Green. Okay, so let's talk about these inclusive institutions that are supposed to be so good for nations. In economics, it's institutions, quote, that enforce property rights, create a level playing field, and encourage investments in new technologies and skills. In other words, the kind we associate with modern market capitalism, you know, with some regulations. You know, like in the US, we have very open markets, but still Walmart isn't allowed to sell black tar heroin. They are allowed to sell guns, though. Inclusive political institutions are those that are characterized by pluralism, which means that they include a number of interests with different political perspectives that can act as checks on executive authority. So success isn't just about democracy or majority rule, as we have lately learned in Iraq. It's about inclusive pluralism. So the nations that Acemoglu and Robinson see as successful are the ones with the most inclusive economies and the most pluralistic governments. Now, they're able to draw a clear correlation, but it's a bit harder to say that these particular institutions caused those nations to become successful. This is the nature of correlation. It's possible that they can be right, that institutions were necessary for a nation to become rich and powerful, but there may be other institutions that matter as much or more than the economic and political ones they identify. Another guy who's written a lot about this stuff is Francis Fukuyama. Fukuyama also believes that institutions are the key to a nation-state success, but in his book, The Origins of Political Order, he identifies the rule of law as the institution that underlies all success. To Fukuyama, the critical thing is that there be a rule of law that is superior to rulers who temporarily happen to command the state's armed forces and bureaucracy. If no one is more powerful than the law and no one can change the law, then inclusive economic institutions and pluralistic political ones sort of naturally come forth. Now, that's not all that different from what Acemoglu and Robinson describe, but there's a twist in how Fukuyama gets there. He argues that the root of the rule of law in Europe as the basis for its institutions is in religion, specifically the Catholic Church. For him, it was the Catholic Church that established the idea that there was a law that was binding even to kings, providing the limits that are at the heart of Acemoglu and Robinson's pluralistic institutions. And this would push the origin of the West's institutional advantages back further than the advent of the nation state, right? Because until recently, religion was far more important to most people than, you know, nation states or capitalistic economic institutions. Fukuyama, you'll be surprised to learn, is a political scientist and classicist by training, so it's not that much of a surprise that he finds the roots of the West's preeminence in governance and classic religious thought. Okay, let's look at one last example of a different approach to this historical question. That guy Ian Morris, who we talked about earlier, he wrote the book Why the West Rules for Now. He broke down his arguments into a mathematical formula based on four dimensions. Energy capture, how much humans have been able to use energy beyond their own muscles. Social organization, which he derives by measuring the largest city in a region, information technology, you know, not just the internet, also like writing and books, and war-making capacity, which we can learn about through archaeology and also traditional history. And then he combines these numbers to develop a social development index that describes the West and the East at various points in history from 14,000 BCE to 2000 CE. Now, Morris is not an economist or a mathematician. He's a classically trained historian, but here he is using numbers, not very sophisticatedly and lots of criticism of them, but using numbers nonetheless. And I think that speaks to how data-driven contemporary academics is. We like things that can be quantified. I mean, many of you are teenagers taking AP World History, and at the end of that, you will take a test that gives you a number between 1 and 5 that tells you how much you know about world history. My number was 2, but hopefully yours will be higher, because I am smarter now than I was then. Now, I do want to note one other thing, which is that you've probably noticed that none of these books question the assumption that the West has been dominant in the world stage over the last couple centuries. That is also a question of perspective. Like, from the perspective of non-human residents of Earth, the West has been a total failure. But there's a certain set of data we look at when it comes to humans, like GDP, the total size of a country's economy, or number of tanks, or innovation indexes, or life expectancy. Through all of those lenses, the West has come out on top in the last 200 years. But that leads us to larger questions about why we measure civilizations and determine winners and losers in the first place, and what that does to our thinking. As Moores points out, one of the problematic things about reducing human social development to a number is that it can dehumanize individuals. Now, numbers are a great shorthand, and they can be very useful for comparisons. Like, I would like to know if my life expectancy will be longer in the United States or in Canada. Stan informs me that life expectancy is longer in Canada, which doesn't make any sense. I always thought that Canada was America's hat. Turns out that we are Canada's pants. Anyway, Stan, we gotta move to Canada. But numbers are always incomplete, and too often we mistake what is easily quantifiable with what is important. Also, when we ask the question about why the West rules or why Western nations have succeeded, what are we going to do with the answer? Is it for Westerners to congratulate ourselves on a job well done, or to explain away the astonishing inequality in the world as being so deeply rooted in the past as to make any efforts to fix it futile? I'd like to think that by understanding what has made the West more successful in certain ways, we can formulate policies that will lead to a general improvement, at least in those ways, around the world. But we've tried to provide here a series of perspectives on a historical question to emphasize the fact that all history has its perspective. It's common to use mathematical measures to analyze contemporary world problems and attempt to find solutions, and that's a good thing in many ways. But when it comes to history and politics, mathematical formulas also have their perspective. And we need to remember that each of those perspectives is necessarily biased to look at some things and not others. Whether it's Crash Course or your world history textbook, it's important to remember that bias is inherent to the experience of writing and telling the story of history. So when you see a number or a claim of success or failure, stop and ask yourself what sorts of information went into that number or into that conclusion. And just as important, what might have been ignored or missed?
Part of the Radio Free Thinker methodology is taking timely breaks, like now. We will return.
She'll make a lovely doll. After I finish with you. I told you your webs were useless.
Spider-Man! He's melting!
It's too hot. It's too hot. Something must have hit the control lever. Turn it.
Oh. Want to save energy and keep yourself comfortable? Turn down your thermostat 1 degree Celsius or consider installing a programmable thermostat. If every household in BC with electric space heating turned down their heat by 1 degree for 8 hours a day, it would save enough electricity to power Science World for over 75 years. This Power Smart Play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker, your odds-on favorite to improve your skeptical life. The next couple of clips are from Healthcare Triage, where the value of testing and how those tests should be used in medical diagnostics is discussed. Hint to the nerds out there, Bayesian probability. Let's test your hearing by listening in.
People assume that when their doctor orders a test for them, that the results are easy to interpret. The reality is that this is far from true. Every test, be it radiological or laboratory, is imperfect. Sometimes the tests miss something that's concerning. Sometimes they pick up stuff that isn't. So what makes a good test or a bad test? That's the topic of this week's Healthcare Triage. Let's say there's a disease out there called fakeitis. But there's no test for it. So an enterprising researcher wants to figure one out. He thinks that fakeitis will raise your white blood cell count, which is really just how many white blood cells you can see under a microscope set at a certain power. So he gathers 1,000 people with and without fakeitis, and he draws their blood. As you can imagine, there are a range of white blood cell counts in this population. So he has to set an amount that he will call a positive result. Let's say it's 15. Anyone with a white blood cell count of 15 or greater is positive, and anyone less is negative. What this or any researcher would do is set up a table like so. Every participant falls into one of these four boxes. Patients in box A have fakeitis and also have a positive test. Patients in box B do not have fakeitis, but also have a positive test. Patients in box C have fakeitis, but have a negative test. And patients in box D do not have fakeitis and also have a negative test. Box A contains what we call the true positives. Box D contains the true negatives. These are both good results, and in an ideal world, all of the patients would fall into boxes A and D. But that almost never happens. Some patients wind up in box B, which we call false positives. They don't have the disease, but they do have a positive test. And some patients wind up in box C, which we call false negatives. They have the disease, but the test doesn't pick it up. We use these ideas to calculate two test characteristics, sensitivity and specificity. Sensitivity is the proportion of people who have a disease who have a positive test result. It's the ratio of true positives to true positives plus false negatives. If you refer to our diagram, sensitivity equals A over A plus C. Specificity is the proportion of patients who don't have the disease who have a negative test. It's the ratio of true negatives to true negatives plus false positives. If you refer to our diagram, specificity equals D over D plus B. Let's fill in the diagram with some real numbers. The researchers gathered 1,000 people. Turns out that 100 of them have fakeitis. Of these people, 90 have a positive test and 10 have a negative test. There are 900 people without the disease, and of them, 750 had a negative test and 150 have a positive test. Sensitivity, remember, is the proportion of people who have fakeitis who have a positive test. 100 people total have fakeitis. 90 of them have a positive test. So the sensitivity is 90 over 100, or 90%. Specificity, remember, is the proportion of people who don't have fakeitis who have a negative test. 900 people don't have fakeitis. 750 of them have a negative test. So that the specificity is 750 over 900, or 83%. In an ideal world, both of these would be 100%. The higher, the better. That almost never, ever happens. So setting the threshold for a positive result at a white blood cell count of 15 led to a sensitivity of 90% and a specificity of 83%. Is that good? Well, it depends what you want to get out of the test. Let's say fakeitis is a really, really bad disease for which we have a treatment that's pretty easy to tolerate. If that's the case, we'd much rather make sure we don't miss any real cases of fakeitis. Looking back at the diagram, we want to minimize the number of false negatives. We want everyone who is disease positive to be test positive. So we could drop the threshold of the white blood cell count to perhaps 12 instead of 15. That might change the results in this way. Now our sensitivity is 99 over 100, or 99%. Our specificity is 500 over 900, or 56%. That's because as you increase sensitivity, you're going to decrease specificity. Another way of putting it is that as you make a test more sensitive, or more able to pick up disease if it's there, you make it less specific, or less able to prove that a positive result is really real. But if you have a disease you want to rule out because it's bad and you don't want to miss it, you want to maximize sensitivity. Sometimes a positive diagnosis is a big deal, and you really don't want to get a false one. Think about a pregnancy test. You're going to figure it out sooner or later anyway, and you really don't want to freak out tons of women, or men. So if fakeitis was like that, we'd actually want to raise the threshold of the white blood cell count to lower the number of false positives. Maybe we'd set it at 18 instead of 15. How might that change things? Now our sensitivity is 60 over 100, or 60%. But our specificity is 880 over 900, or 98%. As we made the test more specific, or more able to prove a positive result is real, we made it less sensitive, or less able to detect disease if it's there. Tests are rarely very sensitive and very specific. Usually it's a trade-off, and we need to consider how much real disease we are missing and how many positive tests are over diagnosis. Here's a real-world situation. I pulled from the medical literature from a manuscript published in 2012. The study involved 141,284 people. Of them, 728 were disease positive. The test had a sensitivity of 83.8% and a specificity of 90.6%. Sounds decent, right? This was a study of mammography in Vermont. And mammography, remember, is considered really important by a lot of people. But mammograms missed 118 of the 728 women with cancer. Is that sensitive enough? Before you say no, remember that increasing the sensitivity would make it less specific. And even with a specificity of almost 91%, more than 13,000 women had a positive mammogram that turned out not to be cancer. These women likely had other procedures, tons of worry, and they had to spend lots of money. And that's a lot of women. The bottom line is that it's unlikely that most of us think about tests in this way. We're likely not considering the trade-offs of sensitivity and specificity in judging whether the test is right for us. But every time we get a test, we have to remember, it doesn't give us a definitive answer. It gives us a test result. And the interpretation of that result depends on whether those who designed the test decided to worry more about sensitivity or specificity. Last week, we talked about test characteristics, like sensitivity and specificity. But while those things have meaning, it's not always clear how they translate into actual practice. To understand that, we have to talk about likelihood ratios and Bayes' theorem. Stick with me. You're going to be glad you did. This is Healthcare Triage. The problem with tests is that we think they're definitive. They're not. We think that positive means you have a problem and that negative means you're safe. I showed you last week that lots of times you have false negatives and false positives. So it's a mistake to take a test and use that and only that to reach a conclusion. This kind of thinking completely ignores what we think about a patient when she walks through the door. You may remember fakeitis from last week. Maybe when we see our patient, we're really sure she has fakeitis. Then a negative result should leave us concerned that it's a false negative. Maybe we thought there was almost no chance she had the disease. In that case, a positive test might be more likely to be a false positive. Or maybe we weren't sure. Then either result might be important. Bayes' theorem, attributed to, get this, Thomas Bayes, takes this idea and turns it into a formula. Mathematically, it says that the probability of A, given that B is true, is equal to the probability of B given A times the probability of A divided by the probability of B. Hold on. Stay with me. In this case, A is having fakeitis and B is a positive test result. So Bayes' theorem says that the probability of having fakeitis given a positive test result is equal to the probability of having a positive test result if you have fakeitis times the probability of having fakeitis divided by the probability of having a positive test result. And I know that that's still complicated, but you don't really need to do the math here. You just need to understand the principle. You look at a patient. You determine based on her story and physical exam what the chance is she has fakeitis. You get a test, and then you do a calculation where you have a new chance that she has fakeitis. And it involves sensitivity and specificity. You use them to calculate a likelihood ratio. A likelihood ratio is the probability that a test is correct divided by the probability that it's incorrect. They come in two flavors, positive and negative, to assess the value of a positive and negative test result. Positive likelihood ratio is equal to sensitivity over 1 minus specificity. A negative likelihood ratio is 1 minus sensitivity over specificity. Bayes' theorem works out that post-test odds equals pre-test odds times likelihood ratio. Now I grant you that odds are not the same as probabilities. Odds are the probability of something being true over the probability of something being false. I know you're likely overwhelmed, so let's work through a real-world example. Last week, we found that mammograms had a sensitivity of 83.8% and a specificity of 90.6%. So first, we can calculate our likelihood ratios. Positive likelihood ratio equals sensitivity over 1 minus specificity. This means it's 0.838 over 1 minus 0.906, or 8.9. A negative likelihood ratio is 1 minus sensitivity over specificity, or 1 minus 0.838 over 0.906, or 0.18. Now let's assume a woman comes into the office. She's really worried about breast cancer. We know, based on research and that paper, that about 0.5% of women in this population had breast cancer. So the pretest probability, based just on prevalence, is 0.5%. That means there's a 99.5% chance that she doesn't have breast cancer. So her pretest odds look like this. Odds are the probability something is true over the probability something is false. In this case, 0.005 over 0.995 or 0.005. And here we see one of the neat tricks about pretest odds that makes life easier. For most relatively rare things, pretest odds pretty much equal pretest probability. Even for things like a pretest probability of 10%, the pretest odds are 11%. So a lot of the time, you can just estimate pretest odds to be the pretest probability. So let's say the mammogram is positive. According to Bayes' theorem, post-test odds equals pretest odds times likelihood ratio. In this case, post-test odds equals 0.005 times 8.9. The post-test odds, therefore, are 0.045 or 4.5%. You can convert this back to a probability by the equation probability equals odds over 1 plus odds. Probability in this case equals 0.045 over 1 plus 0.045 or 4.3%. Let that sink in for a second. The average woman who has a positive mammogram has a 4% chance of having breast cancer. There's a 96% chance that she doesn't have breast cancer. And yet every woman I know who has a concerning mammogram immediately freaks out. That's because most people think that a positive mammogram means you have cancer. It doesn't. It means you have a 4% chance of having cancer. I bet most of you thought you had more than a 4% chance of having cancer before the mammogram was even done. Now, this change is based on clinical suspicion. If you had a lump or a really concerning history, such that your doctor thought you had a pretest probability of 30% instead of the background half of 1%, then your equations change. Your pretest odds would still be probability of something being true over probability of something being false. In this case, 0.3 over 0.7 or 0.43. A positive mammogram would mean this. The post-test odds are still the pretest odds times likelihood ratio, or 0.43 times 8.9 or 3.8. And we still convert back to probability the same way. Probability equals odds over 1 plus odds, or 3.8 over 1 plus 3.8, or a final probability of 79%. This woman with a positive mammogram would have almost an 80% chance of having breast cancer. This is why mammograms can be a really powerful tool for women who are at high risk, but of debatable value in women who aren't. As a thought experiment, I want you to see what a negative mammogram would have meant for this woman. Let's start at the beginning again, remembering her pretest probability is 30%. We remember that her pretest odds were 0.43, and we use Bayes' equation again, but with a negative likelihood ratio, since the test is negative. Post-test odds equals pretest odds times likelihood ratio, or in this case, 0.43 times 0.18, for a final post-test odds of 0.077. Going back to a probability, it's odds over 1 plus odds, or 0.077 over 1 plus 0.077 for a final probability of 7.1%. So after a negative mammogram, this woman still has a 7% chance of having breast cancer. Let that settle in. This woman probably feels reassured with her negative mammogram, but her chance of having breast cancer after the negative test at more than 7% is about twice as high as the first woman with the positive mammogram at about 4%. But that woman's probably freaking out, and she's at like half the risk. This is because people don't think about tests appropriately. Unfortunately, too few doctors do as well. That's because this isn't the way we're trained to think. We think that positive means you've got disease and negative means you're safe. It's just too bad. Now, some of you may complain that although this makes a lot of sense, it's just too hard to calculate. So I'll show you a shortcut. This is a Fagan's nomogram. You start by finding your pretest probability on the left. Then you draw a straight line through the likelihood ratio and wind up at the post-test probability. Once you know the likelihood ratio of a test, it's easy to use. So for the mammogram, the positive likelihood ratio was 8.9. So let's try it for a few numbers. First is the one we did at 0.5%. Drawing the line from there through 8.9 gets us to the about 4% we calculated. You can do this for any pretest probability. You can also do it for a negative mammogram with a likelihood ratio of 0.2. And there are studies which list the likelihood ratios of many, many tests. The Center for Evidence-Based Medicine in Toronto has tables of them at their website. Go knock yourself out. See what a positive and negative test really means. And stop assuming that a positive test means disease and a negative test means you're clear. That's not how it works. The vast majority of us are doing it wrong.
Odds are, you learned something. We'll return after this break.
Making a cuppa? Stop! How many cups of tea are you making? What? There's enough for 10 cups in there. Only boil the amount of water that you actually need. Very good, old boy.
That's right. The British are making less tea to conserve energy. Students can conserve energy too.
A student's life often follows a pattern. Eat, sleep, study. During this routine, don't forget to make time for energy conservation. This will be the easiest thing you do all semester, and a little bit goes a long way. Do your laundry in cold water and hang clothes on standing dry racks or clotheslines instead of using electricity-intensive dryers. If a dryer is the only option, throw in a dry towel with wet clothes to absorb moisture and cut down on drying time.
For more energy-saving tips, go to www.bchydro.com. This message brought to you by BC Hydro and CITR 101.9.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker, your skeptical umbrella in a world of woo and nonsense. And we're back. Let's shift gears and close off the show with another crash course segment about money and its historical role in society. A penny for your thoughts about this segment.
Hi, I'm John Green. This is Crash Course World History, and today we're going to make it rain. We're going to talk about money, the stuff that makes the world go round. Not very good at making it rain.
Mr. Green, I'm sorry, but money doesn't make the world go round. That's actually conservation of angular momentum. It's the same thing that allows, like, figure skaters to turn in circles.
Look, me from the past, I know you came in fourth in physics among all C students in the entire state of Alabama in the 1994 state academic decathlon tournament, but that doesn't actually make you good at science. So here's what economics textbooks say about money. In general, it has three functions: medium of exchange, unit of account, and store of value. And its first function is by far the most important. Like, this is a quote from my actual physical high school econ textbook. In primitive economies, food might be traded for clothing, or help in building a house might be exchanged for help in clearing a field. But exchange today in all economies, market as well as command, takes place through the medium of money. Couple things about that quote. First off, primitive is a cringy word. Secondly, a market economy is, like, you know, basically all economies these days, and a command economy is what we called the Soviet Union's economy back in the 80s. Anyway, money is very important to history. Like, our old friend Adam Smith thought that, quote, property, money, and markets not only existed before political institutions, but were the very foundation of human society.
Yeah,
he was pretty into economies, so he was probably a little biased toward money, but it is important. Smith also thought that before there was money, there was barter, but barter could be cumbersome. Like, if I make cheese and you make shoes and you're lactose intolerant, then barter breaks down because I need shoes, but you don't need cheese. Then I have to live like a hobbit. I get this very powerful ring. It's, like, really stressful. I end up having to go to Mordor. It's just very complicated. So Smith's idea is that rather than adapt to shoelessness, humans created a commodity that they would agree upon ahead of time could be used in exchange, and that commodity is money. Yes, these are all ones.
Dan, I forgot to mention this, but you are buying lunch today.
Now, we generally think of money as, like, coins or later bills, but the material of money is arbitrary. Smith wrote, "In all countries, however, men seem at last to have been determined by irresistible reasons to give the preference for this employment to metals above all other commodity." A sentence that shows you why we didn't teach him in Crash Course Literature. But of course, it's really inconvenient to, like, weigh and measure metals every time you want to buy or sell something, so people hit upon the idea of making coins with a standard size and weight. Now, Smith is probably right that coins are much more convenient than bartering, right? Like, especially if the main store of value in your community is something like cattle. I mean, let's say you still need a pair of shoes. Well, they aren't worth an entire cow. Trading in partial cows, fairly messy. It's also very bad for the cow's health, and the cow loses a lot of its value because, you know, it's no longer living. So that'll make sense, but it's problematic when Smith universalizes that observation by claiming that as a matter of convenience, every prudent man in every period of society must naturally have endeavored to create money. Smith, man of the Enlightenment that he was, is positing that the creation of money is part of human nature. Like, in the second chapter of Wealth of Nations, Smith explicitly says that the division of labor is the, quote, consequence of a certain propensity in human nature to truck, barter, and exchange one thing for another. But yeah, no, like, what made sense for 18th century city and town dwellers like Adam Smith doesn't necessarily apply to, like, all human beings over the course of many millennia. And if you don't believe me, you can just ask anthropologists. They love to talk about this stuff. So here's the fascinating thing to me. When you look at places where the social order is not based on money, we find that people actually don't barter at all. So David Graeber's book, Debt, the First 5,000 Years, surveys the literature of anthropology and discovers that in societies without money, people don't actually barter, but they do find ways to exchange. She quotes an anthropologist named Caroline Humphrey, who concluded, "No example of a barter economy, pure and simple, has ever been described, let alone the emergence from it of money. All available ethnography suggests that there has never been such a thing." Now, that's not to say that barter doesn't exist or that it never has. I mean, I just traded Stan two copies of my book, Paper Towns, for the candy left in this pinata.
Big money, no whammies.
things as sweet tarts. Stan, that's not fair. All right, let's go to the thought bubble. So according to Graeber, barter was reserved for trade between strangers, even enemies. For most of human history, humans lived in small communities, and in those small communities, most exchange took place using forms of credit. Basically, when people know each other well, they're willing to trade with the future expectation that what one gives today will be repaid at some future date with something of roughly equivalent value. So in small, localized communities, everyone is in debt to everyone else, and there's no real need of physical money like coins as a way of keeping accounts because, you know, you remember when someone owes you 40 barrels of beer or whatever. We see this historically in the early civilizations of the Fertile Crescent, where the basic monetary unit was the shekel, and one shekel's weight in silver was the equivalent of a bushel of barley. Money in ancient Sumer was actually created by bureaucrats in order to keep track of resources and move things back and forth between departments, but that doesn't mean that silver actually circulated freely. Graeber writes, while debts were calculated in silver, they didn't have to be paid in silver. So while some people seem to think that money is naturally backed by precious metals, usually gold or silver, that doesn't seem to have been the case. It was enough to establish that something was worth a shekel or a fraction thereof, and then trade for something of equivalent value, wheat or whatever else, without actually having to have the shekels change hands. And this was especially helpful in economies where taxes and payments to workers were both in grain rather than money. Thanks, Thought Bubble. So first, Graeber blows our minds by telling us that Adam Smith was all wrong about money evolving from barter societies, but what about credit as the precursor to money? I mean, he's basically saying that credit cards aren't an advancement so much as they're a return to the glorious past, except instead of trust, there are like large faceless corporations with the power to sue you. So the essence of credit is debt, and at least according to Graeber, that's the glue that holds social orders together, at least if you consider debt at its heart to be about obligation. At least one of the things that binds us together as a community is the recognition that we owe our neighbors something and that they owe something to us in return. It's like keeping your lawn mowed so that you can keep your neighbor's property values high. It doesn't make sense to have a lawn. They're expensive and time-consuming, and you can't eat grass. But you take care of your lawn for the same reason your neighbors take care of theirs, out of a sense of mutual obligation. But money changes our understanding of those obligations, right? Because once we're able to put a price on our obligations, we can make them transferable, which wouldn't be possible without money. Like, for instance, it allows you to hire someone to mow your lawn for you. But Graeber argues that money, especially in the form of coinage, also made chattel slavery possible. So in West African social orders before the arrival of Europeans, money was used, but only for weddings, funerals, and other activities that like cemented human relationships, and the money largely had symbolic value. But when Europeans arrived, they introduced monetized trade into the system, and in the process, transformed that system. Money was no longer about transferring value to solidify relationships between individuals and families. It was about quantifying debt and also making it transferable. So Graeber's theory links money as we know it to slavery and war. Like, coins began to be used in India, China, and the soon-to-be Persian province of Lydia almost simultaneously, all around 600 BCE. And in Graeber's view, this happened because this was a period of time that saw a shift from earlier forms of honor-based warfare, like what is described in the Iliad, to a new, more state-based warfare. Armies started fighting over things like territory and resources, rather than, like, kidnapped wives. So in all three, oh, it's time for the open letter. But first, let's see what's inside my globe today. Oh, look! It's a molten core of nickel and iron. Can you turn into coins? Oh, Stan, look how rich I am! Virtually. Thought Bubble's clearly much better at making it rain than I am. An open letter to honor-based warfare. Dear honor-based warfare, I guess now is the time in the video that I have to tell you that I don't entirely agree with Mr. Graeber. Like, with the Iliad, we were telling ourselves a story about why we went to war, right? We went to war not for resources, but for glory. Honor. Now, I don't want to sound cynical and disbelieving, but we still tell ourselves those stories. These days, the president rarely goes on TV and says, you know why we're going to go to war? We need resources. No, we still say it's about honor and ideas and standing up for the defenseless and etc. Which is all about as historically convincing as the Iliad. In short, honor-based warfare, I'm not entirely convinced that you, you know, exist. Best wishes.
John Green. Anyway, so in all three of these governments, in India, China, and Lydia, they were pretty small scale, especially compared to the empires that would soon come. But they built their power on professional armies that needed to be paid, and coins were a great way to pay them. It just works much better than, like, trying to split up the plunder among everybody. The plundering method of payment is just like a garage sale. The people who get there early get all the good plunder, and then the rest of the people, they're just left dividing up, you know, old clothes. Also, in Graeber's view, states began to encourage the use of coins because of the uncertainty of war. Like, violence creates uncertainty for merchants and decreases the likelihood that they will accept payment in the form of some kind of trust-based credit arrangement. And soldiers aren't known for accepting credit as payment either because, you know, soldiers are keenly aware that they might die soon. So according to Graeber, this combination of war and state building led to the rise of coinage. And then in order to keep paying soldiers, rulers like, say, Alexander the Great, needed to continue their conquests. So you need an army in order to have an empire, and your army only likes to be paid in coins. Now you can seize some sweet, sweet metal plunder, then melt it down and make coins, but with an empire-sized army, that's not gonna cut it. You need more silver. Where are you gonna get new silver? Mining. No, Stan, not miming. I said mining. Don't ever put mimes in Crash Course again. So now you need a steady supply of miners. Fortunately, you've conquered a bunch of people, so you have lots of prisoners of war. And now you have slavery. This military coinage slavery complex was described explicitly in the Arthasastra, a political guidebook written by Minister Cotilia for the Mauryan dynasty that made it clear that coins and markets sprung up above all to feed the machinery of war. He wrote, "The treasury is based upon mining, the army upon the treasury. He who has the army and the treasury may conquer the earth." And Graeber says that China followed a similar pattern. He writes, "The same fractured political landscape, the same rise of trained professional armies, and the creation of coined money largely in order to pay them." So if money is a creation of the state and its military, then it follows that when the state fails, as it did in Europe after the fall of the Western Roman Empire, coinage largely disappears. And that's exactly what happened, actually. But of course, that doesn't mean that transactions fail to take place or that trade completely disappears, but it did decline a lot. And in situations like that, people often revert to the virtual credit systems that we talked about earlier, the ones that rely more on personal connections than on, like, state enforcement. So Adam Smith's origin myth of money, that it derives from people's natural desire to make barter more convenient through the creation of a medium of exchange, really doesn't hold up to scrutiny. I mean, there are clearly examples of an alternate history where production and exchange work okay without actual coins or bills changing hands. It's kind of like today, actually. Money works as long as there is some form of trust and a way to make people meet their obligations. People used to feel obligated because failure to meet their obligations would hurt their standing in their small, localized communities. And now we meet our obligations because otherwise, like, people will take our houses or whatever. But while we have evidence that money, as we conceive of it today, isn't necessary for exchange, it is necessary, or at least very useful, for states. And I think states are probably good. Oh, maybe not. I'm not positive. I just like the internet so much. I don't think we would have the internet without states. So I want to be clear that I don't entirely buy Graeber's version of history. I might be wrong, of course, but I'm not convinced that coins necessarily lead to slavery. And I don't think that ancient slavery is really comparable to the chattel slavery that we saw in the Americas. But I do think that it's important to look at alternative points of view when it comes to history, even when you don't agree with them. It's helpful to understand that there is more than one well-argued point of view in the world. And I do think Graeber very effectively challenges the idea that human beings are like natural, rational, economic actors who wouldn't be possible without money. And in the face of overwhelming anthropological evidence, at least this much is true. Money is not the product of human nature. It's the product of human actions, like the formation of governments and markets. In short, and I know this will disappoint some of the economics majors out there, ultimately, I think my mom was right. We aren't made of money.
And that's all the time we have this week. This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
When Shanna Larson was a little girl, she already had artistic talent, and it was clear that she would be quite an athlete. But Shan always knew what she wanted to do with her life. She wanted to teach. Shan was only 24 years old when she lost her life to breast cancer. And now it's her spirit that will teach us. Teach us to know our breasts. For more information, visit teamshan.ca. Breast cancer, not just a disease of older women.
Mark your calendars. Discorder Magazine's fall fundraiser is around the corner. Wander out of your multi-week post-Halloween stupor and directly into the Astoria this November 19th for live performances by Revered, TV Ugly, Mesa Luna, and Late Spring. DJ Danny Vancouver will have all night sets in between the bands. With doors opening at 8, tickets are only $5 at the door before 10 p.m. and $10 after. Proceeds go towards supporting Vancouver's longest-running independent music magazine. Discorder needs your help to stay in print, so come on up for a night of sweet tunes and keep alt coverage of Vancouver and Canadian music, arts, and culture alive. Visit www.discorder.ca for all the details.
As a station, we believe in playing content with artistic and cultural merit, and sometimes that category includes material which can be construed as offensive. For those who have children nearby or are sensitive to provocative